living in a society that often can induce anxiety, what we can do about it. Hi, my name is Trina Glines, and this is Elevate Your Marriage and Life podcast. This podcast is for those who want to create happiness daily, even among the chaos that marriage and family life will bring. Get ready to elevate your marriage and life today. Welcome back to Elevate Your Marriage and Life podcast. This is Trina Glines. Well, we are going to dive right into part two with therapist Bruce Betcher, who is going to continue to talk to us about anxiety. And today he discusses with us about self-care and the importance of it. And we hear it, but it's always nice to know, well, why and what does it really do for us? And then he also goes in and talks about why anxiety is growing, because it is, and what we can do about it. And then he discusses cognitive behavior, which is a type of mental processing that I really love. And so I'm excited for him to share that with you. And then we also talk about circumstantial anxiety, because often I think most of us, that's what we deal with our life's circumstances just getting so overwhelming. And understanding it will allow us to make better choices to be able to hopefully avoid those moments at least happening as often as they may. So I hope you enjoy the rest of part two with Bruce, and I'm excited to share with you.
I like that. And everything you just talked about with the preventative, you know, all the different, basically self-care is so important for us. And I think women in general, because our natural DNA, I have found through my studies, is we give, we adapt, we give to the point of exhaustion.
You're exactly right.
And we, to the point that we're getting burned out. And we have nothing left to give. And then what we do give is not really helping anyone. It's not giving full-heartedly. We got to make sure we give back to ourselves, that self-care.
It's vital. Mm-hmm. Yeah, primarily because our brain becomes habituated to, oh, what I need to do in order to not feel stressed is meet everybody else's needs. And we neglect ourselves, or we tell ourselves, I'll take care of me when everybody else is taken care of. And then when we get in a pattern of that behavior and we actually do give ourselves permission to take care of ourselves, the emotion that we feel is not what we expect. We don't go, I just took 3 hours and spent it on myself. Generally speaking, we go, that I feel so guilty. There were so many things I should have done. I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't give myself, I'm going to go back to taking care of everybody else because now I feel bad about it. And the analogy I usually use is there's a very big difference between appropriate guilt and inappropriate guilt. You know, appropriate guilt is when I've done something wrong and I need to remedy or fix the situation so that I can feel better about it. But inappropriate guilt is when we feel guilty about not having done something that we should be doing. So an example of that is, let's say I haven't exercised in 6 months and I finally give myself permission to do that. And I go to the gym and I have a good workout and it's difficult and it's challenging because I haven't been there in 6 months and I'm not in shape and it doesn't feel super good, but I tell myself, well, at least I went. I'm feeling good about that. And I go home that night and I go to bed and I wake up the next morning and my body is absolutely screaming at me. I'm sore. Inappropriate guilt would be me saying, this is my body telling me that working out is not good for me because it's painful. So I am never going to go to the gym again, and then I won't have to feel the pain.
Yeah.
And what your body is actually saying is, you know, if you would do this more consistently, we would feel really good about it. It wouldn't hurt. Yeah. But the fact that you've neglected this makes it painful. So when we engage in that self-care or purposeful living, oftentimes that process is how we think about it. We've got to give ourselves permission to say, no, I know I feel guilty about doing this, but it's inappropriate guilt because I'm just not used to it. my self-esteem or my sense of purpose has come for the last 5 years at taking care of everybody else, or never saying no, or always working to please, or feeling like I've got to be perfect. And now that I'm changing that and taking care of myself, I've got to validate that this is what I need to be doing more consistently.
Yeah. And then in the end, we're going to be able to give a more healthier version of us to around us. I mean, everyone will be affected in a happier way by us taking care of ourselves first. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's the only way we can do what we need to do, really. Okay. Because it's twisted thinking. We think I'm just going to, and anxiety drives this, because when we're anxious and stressed, our brain actually shifts and it says, I need more control over my life. If I can just control everything and everybody, then I'll feel less stressed. But what we know is the reality is there's only a small portion of our life that we have control over, our thoughts, actions, behavior, us, right? My brain doesn't want to believe that. What it wants to believe is that if I just control everybody else, then I can feel less stressed. And so we put everything and everybody else first, thinking that it's going to reduce our stress, and eventually it just simply burns us out and wears us down. So you're absolutely right. The reverse model is true. If I put myself first on my to-do list, if I meet my needs first, I reset, I decompress, I now have the energy and motivation to do what I need to do, and I can do it authentically now. I can enjoy it because I feel good about myself. And that's the appropriate stress management model, is me first, not in a selfish way, but in an effective way, that everybody gets the best of me when I feel good about myself. If I don't, then nobody gets that authentic part of me that feels like I love doing this. I want to be doing it. No, I'm doing it because it's on my list and I just need to get it off my list.
Yeah. I think it's quite easy for our family to recognize burnout giving. I think there's a piece, I know for me, I know there's a piece of, you know, a snide remark or a, you know, something that I might say, yeah, I'm giving it to you. I'm not, you know, whatever it might be, that it's not going to be.
Right.
Yeah. They feel it. I can tell when, you know, if there's something I need for my husband, he's like rolling his eyes going, I just don't have time for this right now, you know, but they do it begrudgingly. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I love this. This is powerful reminder of how important it is to take care of ourselves. So powerful.
Yeah.
What do you feel like is the accumulating effect of why anxiety seems to be growing? You hear so much more about it. And even in our kids, you know, I'm hearing even more about kids. Obviously you've got, you know, the ADD and ADHD that you hear about more than we've ever heard before. Maybe it was because we didn't label it then. We didn't know, maybe. But do you feel like there's something in our society that is, well, I mean, you mentioned before, the whole wide world is right at our fingertips at all times. So that has to add some for sure. But is there anything else? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's apparent to me as a therapist that I am seeing, and colleagues of mine are seeing far and far more, you know, anxious based clients. And I think a big part of it, especially with our youth, is just the exposure on social media to the world, you know, whether that's their friends' world, or whether that's the political world, or whether that's the weather world of, you know, Hurricane Harvey. It's just all in our laps anymore. We used to have to work pretty hard, you know, to sit down and open a newspaper and read the newspaper, or turn on the news that only the 6 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news, rather than the 24 hour news. Right. So it's in our laps now. And at a younger age, kids are savvy. They are curious, and they're getting those media links to all kinds of tragedy and whatnot. And so our sense of safety, I think, has diminished substantially. Our emotional well-being in the world, there's a lot of unrest. And again, when we're in our illogical and irrational brain, I work a lot with kids, and I'm always curious when they come in with kind of fears and phobias, let's say about the weather. And they've watched a tornado hit, you know, Kansas on the news, and now they're can't sleep at night because they're convinced that a tornado is going to hit St. George. Well, You know, how many tornadoes have we registered here in St. George? Yeah. And when's the last time you saw your neighbor's house, you know? Well, they don't plug into logical, rational thinking. It's just, I saw it and it's real and it could happen. And so we become poor consumers of our own thinking, and that adds to it. But so I think a big part of it is just how connected we are to the world. I think another part of it is just how driven we are now as a culture and as a society. Those expectations of being the best and being the best at the youngest age and you know, being accomplished by a certain time and having all of life figured out. There's nobody that is providing some checks and balances about the reality of that and what is appropriate. And, you know, I see college students all the time that first year in college, and they feel like they're complete failures because they haven't figured out their major yet. And they didn't take AP classes. So they've got a full 4 years and they feel like they're already behind. And like, where did those expectations come from? Well, my friends in high school all, you know, took AP classes and have, you know, 20 credits, or they all seem to know what they're doing. Well, okay, that isn't necessarily your reality. And so backing off of some of those expectations. But I just think that high pressured sense of we've got to be everything and accomplish everything now in a short amount of time puts extreme pressure on us. And I just think as a culture, we're busier, we are more productive. There is technology that helps with all of that, but it also creates this fast-paced world of us feeling like we can't take time for ourselves. We can't be purposeful about what we do. It all has to be accomplished now and in excessive quantities. And, you know, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, reality of it is, we're on this big blue ball in the universe to learn and also have enjoyment, to have happiness in our lives.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, why would we want to be here if that wasn't an underlining, you know, cause that we desire?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's and it's amazing how caught up we get in that rat race. You know, I took a 2-week vacation this summer. Haven't taken 2 weeks solid in a long time for vacation. And the metaphor that I came back with was, you know, I had learned before my vacation to run on a treadmill at about an 11 level, which is a fast pace. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't pleasant, but I had learned to do it. Mm-hmm. And I could keep up with it. I came back from vacation at about a 2.5 level. And I looked at my world, I thought, why in the heck have I been running at an 11?
Yeah.
There's no purpose in it. Why do I want to get back on that treadmill?
Yeah.
And so when we take time out, when we do all of these things we've talked about, recreate, exercise, connect, decompress, it restores this perspective. And we actually connect with that slower part of life that reminds us that there's joy and peace and happiness and connection. And we go, oh my word, I have been deceived by my stress and anxiety. But most of us don't take enough time off or give ourselves permission to do that consistently enough to reap the benefit of it. And if we don't, we just assume that, well, this pace is what I need to be running.
Yeah. It's such a shame that we have allowed guilt and society or whatever it might be, trying to keep up with the neighbor or whatever, to dictate how we have to keep running. You know,
right.
It's we're missing out on such an important part of life because
you're right. Yeah. And I oftentimes use that example as, you know, we talked about early on, what are the indications of my stress level kind of getting out of control in an unhealthy realm? I use that when I'm at work and I hear somebody say, hey, I'm going to be gone for 3 days on vacation. And I go, oh, I resent you. I can't believe you're going on vacation. You know, or somebody comes in and says, oh, I just went to the best yoga class during my lunch break. Or I just got done with a 30-mile bike ride this morning. And I'm going, biking is so stupid. I can't believe you do yoga. You know, all of that is my resentment about you taking care of yourself and me not.
Yes.
That I'm projecting onto that person. So I mean, that's a good way of gauging that too. If other people are enjoying life and I'm watching them going, how in the heck are they finding time to just sit and relax on their porch? It's probably an indication that I need a little more self-care in my life.
For sure. That's great. That is great. I have discussed with the ladies in my group about the cognitive cycle behavior therapy, where you kind of change the meaning of something that took place. Do you feel that is helpful with anxiety, using that when you're feeling anxious and taking yourself to a cognitive thinking?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and cognitive behavioral therapy is really a great treatment model for anxiety and anxiety disorders, especially phobias and fears, because generally speaking, so that fight or flight center in our brain, it's meant to be functional and healthy for us. It's meant to warn us or alert us when we're in a position of real or perceived danger. Mm-hmm. And the way that it does that is it activates, it floods our body with that stress hormone, and that's meant to give us pause and go, wait a minute, what's going on? Am I under attack or not? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a smoke detector, though. We have to be the consumers of whether there's a real fire or that smoke detector's just beeping because the battery's low or because the stove is burning some grease or the toaster or whatever. Mm-hmm. But most of us habituate to just being reactive. So one of the things that that cognitive behavioral therapy does is what's good for anxiety. Let me say it this way. What's good for fear is not good for anxiety. When there's a real threat, that fight or flight center that activates, I should avoid it. I don't want to get in a car accident again. I don't want to be attacked. I don't want to be abused. So my fight or flight center triggers to cause me to go, hold on, let me take pause and assess what I need to do to feel safe. But what anxiety does, when that part of my brain has gone off or associated an anxious trigger with my fight or flight going off, it causes me to want to avoid doing something that I actually should do so that I eliminate or alleviate the anxiety. So for example, let's say I've been in a car accident, and now anytime I get in a car, I feel anxious, and I start to register in my brain, well, that anxiety is about danger, that I'm probably going to get in a car accident. So I start to avoid getting in the car. Pretty soon I don't drive anywhere because I'm absolutely convinced I'm going to get in an accident. And really what my brain needs, and cognitive behavioral therapy can help with, is it needs some exposure. It needs me to push myself to get into the car, maybe have somebody else drive, and drive while I practice my breathing and my mindfulness so that my brain can reassociate driving with a pleasant experience again. Mm-hmm. And when I can do that, you know, numerous times, now that anxious trigger, when it comes up, I can go, well, okay, I'm feeling anxious about that car accident I was in a while, but I know I can do this. I've got this. And pretty soon exposing myself to those anxious situations is diminished because I have reframed that or reshaped that part of my thought or my brain that says danger, 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 avoid. Instead, I'm saying, I've got this. I can handle it. It might be a little bit of discomfort, but I'm good. Yeah. And cognitive behavior really helps with that. It forces people to kind of confront situations that we may avoid simply because we're anxious, but we don't need to avoid because they're not dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's really good. I like that. That's be one little tool in the toolbox to be able to, you know, resort to right. needed for sure. Would you suggest to somebody who's never had anxiety, never had a problem with anxiety, depression, whatever, and then a circumstance happened, and now they find themselves, you know, having panic attacks, anxiety attacks, that they've never experienced before. It's all new, and it's all just from like a specific situation that's taken place. I've heard of this happening, you know, a lot to people that just had something tragic or just a family matter that was intense or whatever. Now they're having this anxiety. Is there hope that it's going to go away? Like, I know the mind often goes to, am I going to have to live with this all for the rest of my life? You know, we fear that because it happens enough times. Right. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, generally speaking, anxiety genetically can kind of lay dormant a little bit until we have stress or anxiety or situations, then it can kind of activate. But it's not uncommon at all, especially when we look at a specific phobia under the anxiety category or the post-traumatic stress stuff, for a particular incident where a person has not had problems with anxiety for most of their life, and now I've been through an experience, and to activate some ongoing anxiety. And again, going back to that fight or flight center in our brain, two primary purposes that it has. One is to alert us when there's real or perceived danger. And it tries to give us, the second is that it tries to give us ample warning of future danger once there's been an experience. So it's trying to be proactive and protective, but sometimes becomes debilitating. So what happens when somebody's been through a traumatic experience, that part of the brain actually kind of remembers it. It almost videotapes that experience and then stores it like a data file in our brain. And not only does it store the experience, but it codes with that experience every physiological response we had to that initial event.
Wow.
What emotion we felt, what physical sensations we felt, what smells were associated with it. And so it kind of codes that and stores that in a data file. And now, the next time we go out and are exposed to a similar situation where there is a trigger, that trigger activates that part of our brain. It pulls that data file up. Our brain is just trying to be productive and say, hey, be cautious. We don't want you to have to go through that experience again. But in pulling that data file up, our brain starts to recreate all of those physiological responses, and we become convinced that it's happening again. You know, so an example I like to share is with that is when I was about 12 years old, I had a friend who had a paper route. He asked me to substitute for him on his paper route, which I gladly did to make a little extra money. Day two of the paper route, I'm carrying the papers on my back. I'm with bag walking in my own world, listening to my Walkman along a chain link fence where a German Shepherd happened to live. And the German Shepherd was off leash and came over to the fence and startled me to death with this huge bark and its feet up on the fence. And I literally, you know, was just caught off guard and panicked. Well, the next 2 weeks while I'm delivering those newspapers, I'm starting to fold the newspapers before the route, and I'm thinking about that German Shepherd, and I'm starting to feel anxious and nervous. And I'm walking across the other side of the street now when I'm passing. I never saw that dog again, but every day for the next 2 weeks, I had this panic, anxious reaction. If there was a little poodle that barked at somebody else's house, I would startle. It's just a little poodle, right? But my brain was trying to protect me, saying, hey, we don't ever want you to have to experience danger again. We're going to alert you anytime there's a little trigger. So if we're not proactive with that, and that's where all of these resources or therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness meditation allows us to kind of recode those experiences so that we don't register with the same reaction every time there's a trigger. But generally speaking, that's what's happening to people. They're getting triggered. And here's the crazy thing. Once I start to have some anxiety or panic around a perceived trigger, just feeling anxious becomes its trigger itself. Oh no, I'm starting to feel anxious. There must be something wrong. And now my stress hormone starts to flood me with more stress, which leaves me feeling super anxious and hypervigilant. So that's generally what happens when people have an experience sometime midway through life and they haven't been anxious and their brain is still kind of reliving or hypervigilant around, we don't want you to have to be in that situation again. We're going to kind of scan the horizon for danger, and it just keeps us in that state of, oh no, I can't function. I'm anxious. I'm scared. I'm nervous, whatever.
Yeah. Well, and I love that there really are little steps we can take to get ourselves out of that.
That's the key. Yeah. Some people will have to live with anxiety all their life if it's genetic, but it can be so in empowering to learn, oh, all of these little tools can make it manageable. And generally speaking, you know, a post-traumatic trigger can resurface quite a bit, but there is so much that can be done to eliminate that stuff, you know, completely for a lot of people.
So even these people that have a genetic disposition for it, these self-care, self-helps, and mental control that you consciously take can help them. that it can help them have
yes.
a different quality of life and not have them always just on the edge.
Yeah, it really can. I mean, I don't want to diminish for those who really struggle with chronic difficult anxiety. A lot of them have probably done a lot of therapy or work and still struggle. Okay. But for the good majority of people who are struggling with, you know, anxiety or stress gone wild and those types of things, yeah, there's so much that can be helpful in regulating and teaching you how to think differently, how to manage your mindfulness, stay in that frontal lobe, how to engage in self-care, how to live life in a way that keeps your stress level manageable instead of on overdrive. There's just so much that can be done.
Yeah.
There is hope, lots yeah. of it.
I like that. What about if you have a child that has anxiety? As a mom, do you use these same things and try to implement them in the child's life? You know, that we've
yeah.
discussed, the self-care, helping, you know, and just, I imagine you would want to have open communication with them about it, being very specific, not skirting around the issue, but being very specific.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. I will oftentimes tell parents who come in with an anxious child, when you have an anxious child, you have an anxious parent. And unfortunately, sometimes we as parents model how to be anxious to our kids. We're overprotective, we're hypersensitive, we want to rescue and you know, impose our anxiety on them, and they go, oh, well, I should be worried about this. This world is scary, you know, and a certain amount of that is needed and healthy, but too often we create anxiety for them. And so, yeah, a lot of those techniques can be very helpful. The one thing that I always tell parents is never parent an anxious child with your own frustration and anger about their anxiety. You know, if you're not anxious and you've got a child who's hypersensitive, I've got a daughter that's afraid of wasps and she's 14, and I'm at times I want to go, will you just knock it off? This is so irrational. Mm-hmm. But my anger and my anxiety only provokes their anxiety. It only makes them feel more anxious about being anxious.
Yeah.
And so when we try to parent anxiety punitively, all we do is increase the anxiety, because now they go, oh no, I'm afraid of a wasp, and dad's going to be mad that I'm afraid of a wasp.
No. Yes. Yes.
So from a parenting perspective, we want to be calm and nurturing and yes, very, talkative about, you know, teaching them how to talk back to their own brain. It's just your brain kind of going a little bit crazy. It's trying to convince you that you need to worry about something that you don't. Talk back to it. Breathe deep. I taught this same daughter when she was starting to play soccer. She would get that anxiousness before a big game, almost to the point that she was sick. So I taught her some of those breathing techniques back when she was about probably 8 or 9. And she, I would see her in the back seat while we're driving the game doing the diaphragmatic breathing. And I'm like, well, good, she's doing that. That's great. And she actually said it helped. Well, you know, she's out playing on a soccer game. I'm on the sidelines and the other team scored a goal. She was playing defense and I'm watching her and she's out there raising her hands above her head, taking these big giant diaphragmatic breaths. I'm like, what in the world is she doing? And my wife said, she's practicing her breathing. She's anxious because they just scored. So I had to laugh about that. But kids learn that stuff. They can learn to talk back to their brains. They can learn to use those same tools and techniques that are helpful for us just in, you know, a way that makes them make sense of that. And there's some great mindfulness meditation CDs too on that, downloads on that healthjourneys.com website for kids too, that can really help. So
I think that's
so yeah, same techniques can work.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful for us to be proactive in that way with our kids. Because like you said, I mean, I've witnessed and just working with youth around me, especially girls, I'm sure boys are affected as well, but with girls, with the social media aspect of the anxiety, I didn't get invited to that party that they just posted on. And I didn't
right.
all of these things that... social media is full of negative feedback.
It really is. Yeah, constant negative feedback.
Yes. And yeah. So if we teach them that healthy self-talk, how powerful that is for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And how to be compassionate with yourselves instead of letting the irrational brain take over of being critical and assuming the worst. You're right. Learning to say, hey, I've got this. I'm going to be okay. Oh, well, what are, you know, I'll tell parents too, what are the facts? Instead of going on my perception, what are the facts? Well, I didn't get invited to a party, but does that mean I don't have any friends? Does that mean I'm not popular? Does that mean I'm not well-liked? Does that not mean I'm talented or I have great character or have great, no, all of that stuff is still in place. So yeah. The other thing that when it comes to kids too, that you just reminded me of that's so important is laughter is a natural remedy for anxiety and stress. It's ironic that laughter takes place when we're in our frontal lobe, when we're in our emotional center, going back to that airport analogy, and I'm stressed out. I don't think it's funny that people think it's funny watching me go through security at 90 miles an hour, right?
Yeah.
So we lose our sense of humor when we're stressed. But laughter and humor act as a cathartic. When we can engage in laughter, it actually clears out those stressful negative thoughts in our brain and helps restore the frontal lobe functioning. So teaching kids how to laugh at themselves or how to laugh with us about those awkward, uncomfortable situations is such a natural anti-anxiety tool or mechanism. And it's a resiliency skill that they will use for a lifetime over going, okay, I'm not going to feel shame and anxiousness about this. I'm just going to go, oh, well, that was my experience today, and I'm going to find the humor in it, you know?
Yeah.
Be very helpful.
I like that. Well, I've heard through just different studies and stuff how important laughter is just for a healthy emotional state, mental state. So
yeah.
we need to laugh more. We need to enjoy life more and not be so, like you said, in our center, what do you call it? This?
Emotional center. Yeah. Emotional center. I read a number of years ago a study that you know about laughter and the healing properties of humor in terms of stress management, anxiety management. Interesting data. Kids engage on a day-to-day basis, on average, just over 300 humorous incidents a day. We as adults, on average, this is in the United States, we, as adults, on average, engage in roughly 23 or 27 humorous activities a day. So when we look at younger kids, how they're not stressed out, one of the reasons why is they are constantly laughing, enjoying, engaging, and we become far too serious about life, you know, as adults. It's we don't find the humor in things and we take things personally and we catastrophize things. So
I mean, I can think of so many times when like I'm somewhere out and about or whatever and somebody's like really laughing. I'm like, what are they laughing at? You know, you find yourself, what are they laughing at? What's so funny? Yeah.
It's annoying. Yeah. Don't enjoy yourself. You need to feel stressed like me.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. That's so great. Well, I love how you just said a minute ago that there is hope. There's hope for people that do suffer with anxiety. And so much of it is proactive care on our own behalf.
Yeah.
Giving back to
ourselves. It really is.
And I, you know, in, you know, wanting to share with my ladies, I am so for, if this is something that you really suffer with, find a therapist that can step you through these things and help you. And it doesn't have to be a lifelong thing of therapy. It's just, you have the tools to sit down and work with their specific situation and give them, you know, it's very powerful. I believe it's very powerful for it. Not to feel like they're on their own either. And they have a sound.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's one of the things I find as a therapist is that oftentimes when people come in for anxiety or stress related issues and they're helped by it within a few sessions, they consistently say, I wish I would have come in sooner. The trick though is anxiety has a tendency to make us feel crazy. And it convinces us that we're the only ones that feel this, that if people knew what I'm feeling inside, they would judge me, they would laugh at me, I would appear weak. And so anxiety causes us to resist opening up and talking about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And when they come in to meet with a therapist and they're liberated by going, oh my word, you mean more people think this way and more people feel this and other people have had this experience? Mm. It liberates their anxiety from feeling like it's only me to, oh, everybody struggles to some extent with this, and there's so many helpful resources. But if you don't reach out, you're stuck with your own perception that I can't be helped, and this is going to plague me for the rest of my life, and nobody knows what's going on inside of me. I just have to put on this outside shell of, oh yeah, I've got everything under control.
I think that goes right along with what your favorite one-liner was: get busy living or get busy dying, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, if you're not being proactive with your anxiety, it will consume you. And yeah, we have to be proactive.
I love that. Well, I so appreciate you taking time from your day today to share this really, really pertinent, valuable information that I know will directly affect many of the ladies that watch this, and not just them, but their families. They'll be able to, you know, oh, okay, I can apply this to, you know, family members or whatever. And I know you said that you don't do a lot of personal practice. It's mainly through Intermountain, but is there a way that if somebody feels they just have a connection to you that they could try to get a hold of you? I don't know if you do face to face only, or do you offer webinar visits or anything like that?
I do both. Yeah, I do. Some Skype, some face to face. I've done telephone therapy. So the best way to reach me is at my office number, which is 435-628-0624. Okay. Or my email address is sbbmft@gmail.com.
Okay, great. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. This has enlightened me in many areas of, I'm just like, now I'm thinking, okay, now I know. My kids are always like, Mom, you need to laugh more. Laugh more, because they'll make light of something that I think they shouldn't make light of. And I'll be like, hey, stop, Mom, you know you want to laugh, just laugh. And now I'm like, okay, they're probably right.
That's so true, yeah. They're just practicing stress management with you.
Yes, totally. So, in so many aspects, we all have a piece of anxiety in us, and that self-talk is so important. So I really am taking away quite a few things that I want to try to implement in my own self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Share with these ladies. So I really appreciate it, Bruce. You've been very enlightening, and this has been a great discussion. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much for joining me over the last 2 weeks with this conversation that I had with Bruce Betcher. I know I have a lot of takeaways on things that I can change and do to help myself have quite a bit better quality of life if I'm willing to implement some of these things that he has shared. And once again, that's just a reminder to me that in order for us to have increased happiness in our life, we have to be willing to learn about areas that we might be struggling in and why, where does it come from? Because you can't change what you don't recognize. Then once you recognize it, and then you are educated and you learn tools and you learn ways that you could possibly practice the breathing like he mentioned, and self-care like he mentioned, and what does that look like and how can I implement that, then that's just going to take us to that next level that we so desire, that our hearts desire. And of course, this is something I'm very much proactive for in the marriage and family life arena. And us moms, ladies, we get so busy. We get so busy, we forget to take care of ourselves. And this is a really good reminder that you will get burned out if you forget to fill your well. So that is the reason why I did this interview with Bruce, specifically on anxiety, because I work with so many women that struggle with this in their life, and I wanted to give them the ability to look at anxiety from a technical area, maybe understanding the background of it, where it comes from, what happens to our bodies, so that then you can learn that these other skills of, okay, how can I slow myself down in that moment? And what can I do to either meditate, to breathe, get myself to a more harmonious zone than allowing the anxiety to take over? So I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You know, the holidays are upon us and this can bring on a lot of anxiety. So I hope you'll use some of these great preventative measures and ideas that Bruce shared with us for the next several weeks as we go about in these holidays so that you can enjoy the holidays just as much as you hope everyone else is enjoying them, because as givers and adapters, you're going to make sure everybody's having a great time, right? So anyway, thank you so much for joining me once again. If you would like little reminders of how you can increase your happiness in your life and in your marriage, you're welcome to follow me on Instagram at Trina Glines. And I just really wish you some really great peace in your life over this next week. And we will be back at it next Monday. Thanks so much.